Full Service Radio.
Face themselves. They can pretend to be somebody else. Be happy. Be joyous. Come on, you, maestro.
Come on, there's a yes. showdown.
Give me the downbeat.
Okay.
The downbeat.
Get it going.
Wars have come and wars have gone. History goes on and on. But ever since this world began,
yeah!
love not war has conquered man.
Oh, I'm so wow. in love. I'm so in love.
That's a great clip.
Beautiful.
Great musical director you've got here,
well,
Jack.
Welcome, everyone, to the Sun Cinema. Thanks.
Wait,
I'm actually in the house.
Two Jasons here?
I can do this.
Oh, my God. The universe is about to implode. Yeah. Go for it.
Welcome to the Sun Cinema Podcast, a weekly radio show that examines the highs and lows of the medium of film through the filtered lens of Washington, D.C.'s only privately owned art house cinema. I am your host, Jason Cauley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ryan Hunter Mitchell.
Hey, Jason. There's no David today.
No David today. David's at the dentist and, you know, leaves us kind of freewheeling to talk about one of our favorite directors and one of our favorite shows of all time with John Cassavetes. Obviously, that was a clip from The Killing of a Chinese Bookie in 1976, John Cassavetes' film.
Beautiful ending scene of a movie.
Oh, yeah.
We just spoiled the movie for you, yeah, if you haven't seen it.
It's and we can't really spoil it. I mean, there's nobody that I've ever seen or you know, experienced that tells a story like John Cassavetes.
No, he truly nails it.
And I mean, just truly an original filmmaker.
So, yeah, we got together last night and watched Killing of a Chinese Bookie. But we had a good weekend of movies in general. Like
yeah,
we kicked
yeah.
off December at Suns, so we did Lethal Weapon on Saturday.
Great Christmas movie to start the 1st of
good.
December.
You know, and I think this, you can't watch Lethal Weapon and not try to compare it to Die Hard.
Right.
And you were telling me, I didn't know this.
Oh, there's so much weirdness about this. Yeah, the so originally, I want to get this straight, but Bruce Willis turned down the role of Martin Riggs, which is ultimately played by Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon. And after Lethal Weapon comes out, it's such a massive hit that he now, Mel Gibson becomes like, was already a star, but is now like a superstar.
He's the guy.
He's the guy. And he gets offered Die Hard and turns it down, and Bruce Willis takes it instead. And I mean, you couldn't have had that play out any better, because we were talking about like maybe Willis could be Martin Riggs in Lethal Weapon,
but it would be so different.
It would be so totally different. And but you couldn't see Mel Gibson necessarily being Jack McClane in Die Hard.
I can't see him as the New York cop as
right.
much
you
as
just can't believe him.
Bruce Willis is just too perfect at that,
right? And the actual 9mm that's so widely discussed in Lethal Weapon in 1987 as being like this amazing, you know, piece of handheld machinery is also the exact same 9mm prop. Same prop gun that is used by Bruce Willis in Die Hard. It is now retired like in some, you know, glass case at freaking Warner Brothers or Paramount or wherever. But yeah, it was actually used by both of them, that actual...
Damn. What a lucky gun.
Millimeter. Yeah.
And then Sunday, I missed the movie, but you were at Suns.
Oh, man, The Thin Man. What is it? W.S. Van Dyke. It's like 1934. And you see some of these films, and just great films are great films. And they just stand the test of time. And The Thin Man is absolutely, if you haven't seen this, don't be deterred in any way if you're thinking, oh, it's from 1934.
No, it is smart ass. It is so funny.
It is
so clever.
Like, I mean, Groucho Marx kind of funny, kind of beats, you know, the dialogue is so snappy. It's almost like, you know, early Frank Capra, like it, you know,
Well, you get that Dashiell Hammett. Night.
And yeah, because it's ultimately written from, or taken from a Dashiell Hammett novel. And just the play between William Powell and Myrna Loy, who is maybe the most beautiful woman on the planet in 1934. Just like radiant actress. Just the two of them sharing screen time is just something to behold for an hour and a half.
Uh-huh.
The banter, the be ready to drink, especially martinis. If
it's
you've
a
got
drinking
them.
Movie. Yeah.
It's a drinking movie 100%. But,
and the dog Astra, if you like dogs.
Yeah. It's
great,
like,
dog in the
it's
movie.
One of the first movies to like have a dog as a almost a supporting character. I mean, he really is in like every other scene.
Yeah.
And apparently they weren't allowed. There's a story. Gosh, I'm trying to remember. I just watched it the other day. Somebody was talking about the... Oh, Don Rickles, of all people, was talking about the dog Astra. Because Don Rickles was in the first Thin Man TV series.
Oh, yeah, because then it goes on to a series,
yeah,
sequels,
it's a series,
et cetera,
of films, sequels of films, and like I think there's 5 Thin Man movies, and then like in 1958, 59, they started the Thin Man series television show, and Don Rickles was on that and talked about Astra the dog. And it's true, like, you couldn't like touch this dog. He responded only to like these squeezy toys and stuff like that. So you had the dog was like its own entity.
Same dog from the 34 one, actually. They cryogenically freeze it. And they had a lot of weird censorship rules then. You couldn't actually, a dog had to keep one paw on the ground at all in every scene. Otherwise, it was considered. I'm totally lying right now.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait a minute. Where are you going with this?
So we did Lethal Weapon, Thin Man. And then you sat me down to watch Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
Yeah, I think in getting kind of, we'll work our way back to Cassavetes here, whose birthday is this week. That's part of the reason we came up with the idea of talking about
it. Yeah, I hadn't
today.
Seen the movie. We were like, when's his birthday? We should do a Cassavetes episode. Well, turns out it's this Sunday, so.
Yeah, here we are talking
this is
about
for you.
Cassavetes. Yeah. but yeah, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, 1976, and it was recut in 1978, shortened, and actually there's some argument, but most people agree the 78 cutting is a little more palatable because it is, it's like putting your body in a vice when you watch this movie.
which one did we?
We watched the 78.
All right, that one was great. And yeah. I heard the reviews were kind of canned for the first one a little bit.
Right. It was the first one's like 2 hours and 15 minutes, and it's just a little more grueling than you can kind of take most people.
Gotcha.
I've seen both versions. I prefer the 78 version, which is like 1 hour 50, which is what we watched last night. And just some amazing performances and amazing shot sequences throughout the film. But essentially it follows a nightclub owner in Los Angeles who gets into a gambling debt early in the film and is being muscled by the LA Mafia to ultimately kill an individual.
Yeah,
it's $23,000, mind you. Like, yeah. In 1976, it's still, it's a sizable debt, no doubt, but it's like he's not in for like $2 million like you would see in a big Hollywood budget movie or something. Like, this is...
Yeah.
They kind of walk you through the process of how these guys muscle you, and that's part of the intriguing piece to me of the film.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about Cassavetes' version of
a mafia
kind of
film.
Getting tied into the mob.
The story was developed by Cassavetes and Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yeah, he had written it for Scorsese to direct.
Yeah, and ultimately took it and did it himself because Scorsese was doing some little movie called Taxi Driver at the time.
Yeah, I've heard of her. Yeah, but this movie, as far as mob movies go, it's really genuine. I mean, what the hell do I know? I know nothing of the mob, but
course.
It seems more believable. They're not necessarily a fantastic mob movie. If there's an arbitrary $2 million and someone's finger needs to get cut off, it's much more subtle.
Yeah.
Like the idea that somehow $23,000...
This is more like the Goodfellas version, like the blue-collar gangster type.
But then, like a hyper realist, even with Goodfellas.
No, I'm just saying, yeah.
It's following those characters, the kind of.
Right, it's at a lower
ground
level.
Yeah,
grunt working, level mafioso types. Not
definitely.
A godfather, kind of in a big giant house kind of thing. This is very street level, putting pressure on little guys who are in trouble.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, so there's a scene where he realizes his credit is low at this high-stakes gambling party, and he's $23,000 down. And it's not your classic mob get roughed up. There's no explicit exchange of anything nefarious. He just kind of gets pressured into, okay, here's
a couple documents you need to sign.
Yeah.
And he has no idea what he's signing. It's just put in front of him. I mean, there's no,
he doesn't get to have a conversation about this.
It's like he's standing in a 4 foot above ground swimming pool with sharks in it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what the scene feels like. The guys are just kind of moving around the room while he's kind of being ushered over to sign these documents. He has no play. You know, there's no out for him, and you can just feel it in the tension in the room.
And I imagine something like this actually happens probably all the time when there's big gambling debts. You don't necessarily get roped into being asked to kill someone later, but I'm sure there's some pretty...
Well, they do a scene, the small scene right before that where the doctor is in there. They're all like waiting their turn in the lobby to go back and deal with these heavy hitters. And the first couple goes back, and it's this doctor and his wife.
Yeah.
And he's trying to play it a little tough, like, hey, you'll get your money. It's $5,000. And they're like, yeah, well, we need it right now. And they're like, well, give me 30 days. And he's like, no, that doesn't work. We need it right now. What else you got?
Yeah.
And they end up just like, hey, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take all your files. You're a doctor. We're going to take every one of your files just so we have, you know, dirt something. Or whatever on somebody.
Yeah, so everything seems a little creative. I'm sure he's actually talking to people in every industry that's in these and kind of knows his way around seediness.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it feels of a time and a moment, like mid-1970s in L.A., and it's shot like on the street, location shooting, just... feels very, very real, and you can't. That's what kind of pulls you into this otherwise very, you know, small film about, you know, character-driven film that just makes you feel like you're living moment to moment with this guy, and you feel this noose tightening around you the whole time.
In case people aren't too familiar with Cassavetes, maybe we should go a little bit into his background as a filmmaker.
No, absolutely.
He was actually filming way before the 70s.
When you think about Cassavetes, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people in a lot of different places, but I think about there were three guys in my mind that really influenced the film school generation who weren't of that generation. They were Alfred Hitchcock, Jean-Luc Godard, and John Cassavetes. Mm-hmm. Cassavetes' first film was 1958. Just to kind of give you some reference of when he started making films.
And this is Shadows?
Shadows, yeah, which was a total, like, we talk about independent filmmaking, this was as independent as it gets.
Yeah, and it's improvisational, interestingly shot.
Yeah,
and
it's shot in documentary style, which is kind of what he's known for throughout his career, is this very loose camera work style, a lot of handheld, just very hard cuts in and out of scenes. It can be a little jarring until you realize like what you're getting in return from that little bit of jarring on some of those cuts is a thing that I can't stand in films, which is, and we talked about this a little bit last night, you get away from exposition by doing that. He's mm-hmm. getting you in scenes late and out of scenes very quickly.
Early, yeah.
Yeah.
And now you see this in every, I mean, Lady Bird is chock full of this.
Oh,
you
yeah.
see
Noah Baumbach.
Any of the Noah Baumbach stuff.
Yeah. Even guys like Wes Anderson, certainly Paul Thomas Anderson, heavily influenced. I mean, if you watch Inherent Vice, go watch Killing of a Chinese Bookie and then watch Inherent Vice and you'll see it. And
I mean,
it's undeniable.
Yeah. It's basically, you don't know that you're in Inherent Vice and then you're like, oh, I just watched a better Inherent Vice.
Yeah. And I'm taking nothing away from these folks. They're the best filmmakers working today, in my opinion. But they are all, without a doubt, and I think every one of them would tell you to your face that John Cassavetes had a major influence on their filmmaking style.
Yeah, so his style is so interesting, verite, sharp cuts, and then he explores really interesting narratives and kind of uses these improvisational essay formats that were being used by like kind of real artistic directors in the 50s, and he uses them to tell a long story that gets you places you just couldn't get into the places these characters get into
right
in another by another director. It just, I don't see it happening. He just kind of crawls into a real specific interaction between these guys.
Well, I think that's what he does best, is he gets down at a ground level with his characters. And there's not a lot of grandstanding. There's not a lot of grandiose, big, you know, kind of flourishes with anything. It's very much, let me get right to the heart of this scene. Let me get right to the heart of the psyche of this character and put you in that place. And we're going to deal with that. And then we're going to get out of it. And we're going to go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know?
On to the next dive.
Yeah. To the next dive. On to the next scene. Yeah, restaurant.
Every character. I mean, he owns this show busy Sunset Strip strip club.
Yeah.
The Crazy Horse
Crazy
West.
Horse West. How good is that?
And it is. So it's essentially a performance.
Burlesque.
A burlesque. Kind of. Strip club.
It's a throwback to kind of a burlesque show strip club type of place, and it's undeniably seedy and also undeniably interesting. And we were talking about it last night. We're like, did places like this even exist? And I think they did. But it's before our time. I'm happy to take any 60-year-old callers who were in L.A. or New York or anywhere.
This
was a happening type of thing. But it is truly like this, you know, there's an MC that comes out. The girls are out. This is like Paris-themed, you know, performances. And then they go to, you know, some other type of performances. So, I mean, like these are all written, scripted scenes that Ben Gazzara's character in the movie, who owns the Crazy Horse West, is writing and producing in this little kind of seedy strip club, you know?
Yeah, there's some like sincere dedication from his character. Like, he
the
truly
creative
loves
part of it.
So first you walk into this movie, you see, okay, it's this nightclub owner. He's into gambling. He's into polyester. Looks like a shithead.
Yeah.
Cool. Great. I'm going to watch a movie about a bunch of 70s guys doing this. And then throughout the movie, you start realizing the movie could have been about any one of these characters.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, every one of the dancers in it is so full. He must just let the characters get into their character and then talk, act how they would. I mean, it doesn't seem entirely scripted.
I've read quite a bit about Cassavetes and his process of work. They did do a lot of improvisation, but it was improvisation in rehearsal to get it to a script form.
Work that way.
Yeah, and he would let them kind of improvise, you know, weeks prior to shooting. But by the time they got there, it was
they knew what they're doing.
90% on the page.
Yeah,
you know that. Okay. And there was a little room for, you know, for movement. But it still lends itself to this kind of, like you said, cinema verite or documentary style when you're watching it, and you have to like stop and notice. At times with, you know, he does all these crazy extreme close-ups and...
and they'll last for a minute and a half, just a close-up. Doesn't even matter if someone's shoulder gets in the way of the close-up, you're going to see 20 seconds of the shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's just leaving it there for you to kind of stew in the middle of what's going on.
But you're stuck on it. It doesn't need quick editing. It doesn't need fancy camera angles changing all the time. It really just...
Right. And he's so good at just... I don't think he gets enough credit as a director of just knowing where to put a camera in a scene, you know, and let things unfold in front of it. Cause these aren't like on a 2 second, 3 second, 4 second interval. You know, I mean, these are scenes that are playing out, you know, 45 second shots, you know, oners after the other, but not in a gimmicky kind of way. Mm-hmm. Just, he knew where to put the camera to let, you know, all of the scene unfold, whether it was handheld or on a tripod, and he switches back and forth in the same scene. You see him going handheld for a second, and then, you know, the reverse shot is on a tripod because he's going for a different effect and just kind of continuing at the same time to like pull you into these characters' lives.
Yeah. If they're claustrophobic, you're incredibly claustrophobic.
Yeah.
But all without, I mean, we were kind of analyzing it this way to try to grab this stuff, but it's so natural. It doesn't feel, not like, oh, let's make this guy look like a bigger character and shoot from underneath. It's not hacky tricks. It's
I'm taking nothing away from Scorsese or any of the film school guys, but I mean, like, they give you like those shots where you're like, well, this is a masterful, you know, director's kind of shot, like the oners that they do. Spielberg's, you know, notorious, not notorious, but well known for his oners.
Notorious.
And Scorsese, of course, with the Copacabana, mm-hmm. you know, shot in Goodfellas, and just his fast zooms and things like that. But they feel very much, and they're super cool, and I loved them. But they feel very much like this is a director doing something. And yeah. Cassavetes kind of eschews all of that and just still does the wonders and still does all these things. But it's all in service to this character.
Yeah.
All the time. I feel, at least that's my opinion.
Yeah. I was kind of feeling, I was like trying to look up like who are the influences on Cassavetes. And I don't know, maybe you know, but he seems like more influenced by like poets or beat writers, jazz.
He was a big jazz fan.
Than he does by Hitchcock or anyone else.
Right.
I mean, he just seems like he's like, no, let's go make this.
Woody Allen said something very smart on what we're going to. Yeah, exactly. we can eschew Woody Allen, but he did say, you know, I mean, he's an incredibly intelligent guy. And he said something that I thought was really interesting. I just heard last night doing some research for today's show, but he was talking about how. There are a handful of directors who could just live in a closet and write and, you know, make their films in absolute isolation because they're not influenced by anything else. Uh-huh. You know, like their type of movie isn't going to be able, not even if they wanted to, they couldn't steal from other directors. Sure. Because it's such a unique vision.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming completely out of their own head.
Yeah.
And he didn't mention John Cassavetes by name, but I thought of Cassavetes when he
Definitely.
Said that. And he was talking about guys like Mel Brooks and some others.
Sure.
You know, who are definitely, you know, just their own entity.
Well, here's Richard Brody from New Yorker, who I guess we end up reading his articles a lot. He's a bit of a guy.
Yeah, you, Richard Brody, if you ever see anything come up with his name on it, just assume that it's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, it's worth a read pretty much all the time. But here's, he did an article a few years back on Cassavetes. Cassavetes, who was born in 1929, was almost 40 when he found his style, and for the rest of his career, he died in 89. He filmed a generation that was out of sync with its time, one that was being edged from the spotlight. He filmed people who drank, smoked, gambled, who wore tuxedos or gowns, who frequented nightclubs, and whose music was jazz and standards. Their shambling expressivity and daily theatricality bore the pinpoint idea of a sharp-edged elegance, a sense of dressed-up style that, by the time he filmed it, was an icon of survival, even a mark of loss.
Oh, wow.
This result is cinematic modernism at its most romantic.
I love that. That's a great summation of kind of who Cassavetes was as a filmmaker.
Yeah, he's
and
getting
the characters
the guys
he developed.
Yeah, tuxedos all over the place, but it doesn't feel it isn't selling. It isn't like
right.
You're not convinced that anyone's glamorous.
Oh, you don't. Yeah, these are not people you're aspiring to be like, you know, these
Definitely.
Are not people right out of the gate. You're already in a place where you're like, I'm in an unfamiliar territory with these people.
Uh-huh.
I'm highly intrigued by the world that they're living in, but it is generally, you know, pretty depressing and sad. And, you know, at the same time, like I said, very intriguing and I'm struggling to find the word.
Well, I feel like it's kind of disappearing too, like how you said this nightclub, you know,
right.
Like where did that place exist? Did
right.
it exist? And like maybe it did, but even by the time he shot it, it was probably barely existing anymore or fading out.
Right.
It's like this certain,
the people on the fringe. Yeah.
Yeah. Just.
Oh.
And then after that, we just watched a bunch of Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
Which leads us to our next segment. Let's play that Dick Cavett intro with Cassavetes.
Oh, yeah, please.
Dick Cavett Show, 191, VTR 91870, Air 92170, take two.
I love this.
The Dick Cavett Show, with special guests, John Cassavetes, Peter Falk, Ben Gazzara, and Bob Rosengarten and the orchestra.
All right, give us
ladies
your...
and gentlemen.
Oh God,
Dick Cavett.
Give us your Dick Cavett talk, Jason. Why are we talking Dick Cavett?
Oh, listen. I don't know if our listeners are familiar, but you can go on YouTube and find almost, maybe not everything, obviously, but a ton of Dick Cavett shows that are already like pre-cut, but the full episode. So just take some time, type in Dick Cavett on YouTube, because there's nobody that I've seen before or since who kind of did what Dick Cavett did, which was, you know, had guys on, guys and gals on to just talk about their craft, whether that was, you know, filmmaking, you know, or performance of any kind. I mean, everybody from Jimi Hendrix and John Lennon, David Bowie, he had Frank Zappa on in 1970. I mean, who does that?
But also like Jimmy Hoffa, yeah.
Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer.
Yeah.
And,
political, you know, figures. Yeah. So yeah, here we are on the Sun Cinema podcast, digging up a dying breed of Cassavetes, and Dick Cavett's still alive, probably.
Dick Cavett's still alive.
Certain era of late night and morning talk show television
that was unlike anything else. I mean, again, you just wonder if there's room for this now to take place, because I would love it if somebody were out there doing that right now with Paul Thomas Anderson or something. Can you imagine like a Dick Cavett type show where, hey, we're just going to spend, you know, the better part of an hour just talking to Paul Thomas Anderson. He's not pitching a movie. You know, so he's not obligated to do this or that, but he's just going to be able to talk about film, his influences, how he makes film. And I feel like there's an audience for that that is just not being served today. And maybe I'm wrong, and I hope, you know, if I am wrong, somebody call in and tell us, like, where the great...
just call us.
Where the great Dick Cavett-esque type stuff's being done now, and I'll gladly go look it up. But I don't think anybody from... You know, and I like all of these guys, but Colbert is maybe the closest in Dick Cavett's own summation. But, you know, Fallon and all the other guys, nobody's doing what he did. I mean, he came out, he would do a brief, you know, 1 minute intro, usually pretty funny, you know, a couple of quips, and then he got right into it. And these guys would come out. I mean, there's one you should look up specifically on YouTube that is just Robert Altman. Listen to this lineup. In one night, you have Robert Altman, Mel Brooks, Peter Bogdanovich, and Frank Capra on one panel, just sitting around talking about movies and how they make movies. And nobody's pitching. Smoking a lot of cigarettes, and nobody's pitching anything.
Jack, we can smoke in here, right? For this episode.
I've been smoking.
I already am.
Okay, good. So for context, Dick Cavett, you know, late night show host, kind of like Colbert or any of these others, except his format was a 90-minute show where he would pretty much have a guest to a few guests,
right,
and just have a conversation with them the whole time. I think Fresh Air or Inside the Actor's Studio, but hosted with a little more personality. Someone like Colbert, I think, would be kind of the most similar in
that
in
caliber of interviewer. Yeah,
but it wasn't jumping around a lot. Occasionally it would kind of be a variety show, but still working with that same person, and only if the sketch or bit kind of played into explaining that person or letting them express themselves in a certain way.
Yeah, and there was just something about the time and place, I think. I mean, he hit it right. I think it was 68 to 75 was kind of his prime late night show. Of course, he came back in the 80s and even in the 90s to do it again in a more limited way. But that prime, like 68 to 75, 76, he was able to get, just because of, you know, that time, all of these old guys like Capra and George Cukor, you know, Orson Welles, are all still alive and kicking, you know, and happy to talk. And then you've got all the up-and-comers of the Peter Bogdanoviches and the Spielbergs and the Robert Altmans, I mean, and
everybody.
Yeah, that are just now, like, coming on the scene. Mel Brooks, you know, that are just, like, knocking it out of the park, and everybody's just happy to talk about, the you know, their craft of filmmaking and who their influences were. And
well, Let's play that Mel Brooks on there.
Oh, this, yeah, it's just like a funny intro. Mel Brooks, you know, being introduced on Dick Cavett on the panel with Altman and Bogdanovich and Capra, by the way.
Good evening, ladies and germs, and welcome to a bang-up variety show presented by a fourth boys here at the Big DC Show.
Oh, no.
We have a swell high-class show tonight, strictly loads of talent, lots of laughs, and I'm going to be your compere. That's French for MC, that's initials for metal case. But I want to tell you...
So often he gets like this panel of like, oh, all of these people gel so well together. And Mel Brooks kind of does gel, but he...
Well, let's put it in perspective. I highly recommend we introed with the Dick Cavett piece with John Cassavetes, Ben Gazzara, and Peter Falk as his guests. These guys come out absolutely hammered.
Would kill us how hammered these guys
are. Like
worse than us.
Absolutely hammered. And they are... You know, Ben Gazzara smoking a cigar the size of a wiffle ball bat. And, you know, Cassavetes is smoking, Falk's smoking. I think Ben Gazzara still has a drink in his hand when he comes out.
They all have drinks in there, don't they? They're all drinking.
They definitely all had been drinking heavily. And they absolutely go on. And for the first, I think, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes.
They don't really talk.
They don't speak. And they'd all gotten together backstage and just said, "Hey, we're just going to stonewall them. We're just going to come out and sit down and not talk." And Ben Gazzara finally breaks it, and they give him all kinds of shit for it. But, I mean, like, who does that? I mean, who can even get away with that and make that entertaining?
Yeah, you know? And Cavett keeps it together while that's happening.
Oh, 100%.
He kind of realizes, okay, they're not going to bite. They're doing a bit, whatever this is.
Whatever I've gotten into.
He plays off of that and keeps an interesting conversation.
This is why I never joined a fraternity.
Yeah, so when he has Bogdanovich and when he has Altman, I mean, he's getting pretty serious discussions about film.
Oh, quite, yeah.
The process, decisions to use black and white versus color.
Yeah.
Or organic processes of filmmaking.
And whether or not you had control of your film, you know, and Frank Capra talks about that extensively, about having control of Final Cut. You know, and being able to do that inside of a studio system, is the old Hollywood system dead or not? I mean, like, just intriguing conversations if you're, you know, cinephile at all, and love movies. It's something well worth watching.
Yeah, and Mel Brooks holds his own great. When it becomes a serious conversation, he also is a great filmmaker.
And yeah, just completely insightful.
Well, it's funny you say inside the studio system. Back to Cassavetes, which we'll do at another time again, I'm sure. But another thing, Cassavetes was a great actor who just did acting basically to raise
money. Yeah, Oscar-nominated actor who basically just did it to finance his own pictures.
Yeah, use his good looks, get a good acting gig, take the money, and make a movie that producers couldn't mess with him.
Well, and I mean, most times, I mean, these were not, you know, films. Even after he was well-established as a great, you know, director and being nominated for awards and things like that, he was still taking, you know, 2 years to make a movie because they would just run out of money, and he was just refusing to take money from studio.
Cool guy.
Yeah, I mean, to say like Maverick and all these kinds of things, like those are kind of easily thrown around, I feel like, but he was truly kind of a maverick filmmaker who did his own thing. And, you know, again, like his... You might not have Mean Streets without John Cassavetes, you know, not just in the way Scorsese shot that, which is very much Cassavetes style in a lot of in a lot of ways, a documentary kind of feel to it. But he was actually with Cassavetes. Scorsese was with Cassavetes in Los Angeles shooting Boxcar Bertha, which was...
I never saw one. But.
Yeah, and it's like a mediocre picture. It's part of the... oh God, I'm gonna totally blank. Roger Corman.
Machine factory. When Scorsese made the movie for Roger Corman. Yeah, I remember hearing this.
And Cassavetes just like pulled him aside and said, like, you know, what are you doing? Don't you have anything original you'd like to say?
Don't hang out with Corman. You're gonna make Hollywood trash movies.
Yeah, and he's like, go back to New York and make your movie. Yeah. What movie is that? And Scorsese told him about Mean Streets. He's like, well, that's the movie you got to make. And at the same time, they were having conversations about
Chinese
killing
bookie.
Of a Chinese bookie. Yeah.
Was Scorsese ever on Dick Cavett? Just to get back to
Dick Cavett. He was never on Dick Cavett that I can find. Like, he's the one guy. And, I mean, there's literally, you know.
Yeah, Hitchcock, Godard.
Freaking Godard. I mean, on Dick Cavett.
That's insane. Bergman?
Bergman, yeah. Ingmar Bergman. Was on Dick Cavett. Orson Welles. It was like Orson Welles and Jack Lemmon on one night on Dick Cavett.
I mean, that's another insane. Huge Dick Cavett thing, which is, you know, obviously kind of propels him into a certain stardom, even a little bit bigger in the 70s, is he was the guy who wouldn't drop Watergate, too. Like,
right.
He was a real pest about that. I think Nixon had everyone who worked on the show audited by the IRS
right.
to, like, vindictively get back at them. But he really... was getting high level get well. Then Ted Kennedy comes on.
Absolutely. And you get
Kissinger. Gerald Ford is on.
Right.
I mean, he gets everybody in there, and he kind of wouldn't drop this Watergate thing.
Right.
Barry Goldwater. I mean, he's Goldwater, like, oh yeah, we don't want to. Yeah, it was a little robbery. We didn't learn anything. It's just not an important thing. But he wouldn't drop it. And when you, that's something in the format that is not there now. And
yeah.
This is definitely there. You get 90 minutes. You can make someone sweat. If you're a good interviewer, you can make someone sweat, and you can also keep it interesting, make people continue to want to watch it. And with dissections like that, I mean, who knows without Dick Cavett if Watergate would have just lost momentum,
right.
Lost popular attention? I mean,
taking nothing away from Woodward and Bernstein, who were, you know, doing God's work at the Post. But
sure. No, of course. But how many more people were watching than reading the Post?
For sure.
Like with
at a national level,
yeah.
Dick Cavett was hugely important in the Watergate case coming to light and staying in kind of the forefront of people's conversations, you know.
Which I think goes back to how you're saying, you know, late night now, just to start off with just late night, because he's kind of in the late night.
That's who he was, world. Yeah.
Late night is pretty cheesy right now. I don't watch enough of it, and maybe it's not that cheesy, but...
I think there's like, yeah, people look at Fallon and what he did with The Tonight Show and kind of revitalize that. But it's a lot of games. It's a lot of fun and all that. And that's you know, maybe that's what people want to see, you know.
I know, but at some point, you know, when you give people what they want to see, I think that's an excuse for why television media has, in my opinion, kind of become lowest common denominator. Just kind of quick, fun, not too heavy, you know, to think about kind of material that happens on almost any television network, like not online TV. It's a little bit different, but I think of mostly television, specifically late night. It's real cheesy. It's fun. You get some cool songs, some cool games, but you don't necessarily get pushed. You don't necessarily see someone have to wiggle
right
their point of view. And like,
and most of the time it's because they're working on a guest who's got 15 minutes. You know, that guest is going to be on for 15 minutes. They've got their agenda that they're going to push. Or they've got, you know, contractual things that they have to push, like filmmakers coming on. You know, they're going to spend 15 minutes talking about that movie because that's what, you know, they have to do. And, yeah, you're not getting into a deep conversation with anyone on television in 15 minutes.
I don't even know that there is 15 minutes. I feel like it's eight.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is
even eight. Maybe I'm not counting and not watching much of this stuff, but that is a problem. I think we're not getting in really popular media. We're not getting a certain discourse that's thorough, that makes us think a little bit more. And I know you can always, it's always golden age. Like, oh, we love the old time.
Sure.
You know, we love the things before. I feel like there are things that do it now, but it's all peripheral. It's all kind of fringe media. There are some podcasts, such as the Sun Cinema podcast, that does hard-hitting interviews. No, but maybe there's like, what, Joe Rogan? Yeah, like that's our Dick Cavett now. He gets I know it sucks. Like, but is that where we're having a long
Mark Maron?
Or Mark Maron. Okay, yeah, Mark Maron. I guess that's
strangely right.
Actually, Maron is more similar to Dick Cavett than I think.
I would agree with that.
I don't like Maron really. I mean,
I wasn't.
But he seems like a fine guy. But I just
sure.
The show.
It's a little exhausting to me as well. Just kind of getting to the show, and I'm
here we are on
a podcast talking about another podcast. So and talking about an insanely successful podcast. Let's be clear, Mark Maron doesn't need our endorsement or detraction, but it is to me a little. There's nothing like Dick Cavett. right now.
Sure. But now I'm wondering if we're just really out of touch, which is also possible.
Please call and tell us we're out of touch and tell us
yeah,
who...
see, no one called. We're in touch.
Right. Everybody agrees.
Well, I mean, with Instagram Live or whatever, right? Like, anybody can kind of do their own talk show appearance when they want.
And that is interesting, and I am open to that pushback. I do think that is something. So I might just land on maybe just television or primetime television or late-night television has become so
unnecessary?
No, not even. Just like, it doesn't challenge you. It's unchallenging.
Right.
And not thorough and just a nice little...
Which causes it to lose its relevance and, you know, as yeah. far as what impact it has on, you know, the nation at large.
Yeah, maybe Marc Maron and Two Dope Queens and some cool stuff that gets some, you know, numbers, some listeners, some watchers. Maybe some of those things are kind of doing interesting things in the vein of Dick Cavett. Definitely. I mean, there's plenty of stuff out there.
They are.
But nothing on like a huge platform that a lot of people are watching that allows us all to relate to the same thing, to kind of have a cross-section of our narratives.
Right.
Like Dick Cavett. Or maybe, I don't know, because what the fuck? I wasn't even alive during Dick Cavett, because I just like watching the old ones. But yeah, you get inside the processes of people and you really get their worldviews, and they get pushed back and forth and run through the mill on his show.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing I would like better than to have, you know, like I said, you know, a panel today of, you know, the greatest working filmmakers or some of the most interesting original filmmakers to come in and sit down for 90 minutes and just talk about their process of filmmaking, or to get a political figure on to really dive into something for 90 minutes.
Yeah,
you know?
That's I mean, something.
You're not staying on talking points for 90 minutes if you've got somebody with the caliber of Dick Cavett, you know, asking questions and probing and trying to get to the real meat of the discussion. It's just, that's hard to do. I don't care what politician you are. Nancy Pelosi's maybe one of the greatest I've ever seen at just being on message and staying on message mm-hmm. despite everything. I think you couldn't stay on message for 90 minutes.
No, you know? She turned down our show because she was afraid we'd push too hard.
Right.
I blame the smoking ban. Maybe if we let politicians or performers smoke inside, we could actually get four of them together for 90 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we can't. They yeah. could.
But I seriously, like, there are hundreds of Dick Cavett interviews on just YouTube. Just go find them. They're well worth revisiting if you saw them when they were originally out, or if you've never experienced what we're talking about and wondering, just type Dick Cavett into the YouTube search and you'll get there.
Yeah, if you were listening to Full Service Radio and it randomly picked the next episode of something after your podcast that you wanted to listen to was over, and you stumbled onto our podcast and now it's about to be over, I recommend YouTubing some Dick Cavett. Leave it on while you're cleaning the house or doing some dishes. It's great conversation. It works as like headphone material now for your commute. Like,
absolutely.
Watch a YouTube video of Dick Cavett. Listen to Marc Maron's podcast. Listen to Joe Rogan. Watch all these other media that are far more popular than us.
There's a podcast I found that's pretty good, too. Here's a little clip of that.
Tape okay. these days, Frank. You just record it right onto the computer.
And once we start recording, Frank, I'm going to need you to stop eating those crackers. It's incredibly annoying, and it's all anyone's going to be able to hear. So, Dennis and Dee Reynolds here.
Inaugural podcast. We're talking technology today, the big T.
Absolutely. Everyone's talking about technology these days because it's everywhere.
Oh, it is. You can't escape it.
You absolutely can. So, Dee, tell us what you feel about technology. How do you, what's your opinion on it?
We need more crackers in the studio, Jack. All right, well, thanks for listening to the Sun Cinema Podcast. Thanks, Jason, for having some time off to be able to talk Cassavetes.
Absolutely.
Let's play out the very end of Killing of a Chinese Booker.
Gee, we'd like to see you looking swell, baby. Dolled up, dressed up, raising Cain and hell. Baby, till that lucky day, you know damn well.
thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO and Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.